Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Good morning from me, Richard Heller, in southeast London. It's a rather overcast morning. On the day we're recording, may I wish a slightly belated happy birthday to Neil Harvey. He was 93 yesterday as we record. Great Australian batsman and the last survivor of the Australian Invincibles of 1948. Peter is absent today in Pakistan, interviewing the Prime Minister, another former cricketer, and very glad and grateful to welcome our friend Mihir Bose to be the 12th man for him. Mihir is well known as a broadcaster and author, former sports editor of the BBC. He's been a guest on this programme, explaining the modification of Indian cricket, and his latest book, we strongly recommend, Narendra Modi, The Yogi of Populism, is a very good further explanation of Narendra Modi and his impact not just on cricket but on India. Mihir, thank you very much for stepping in for Peter.
Well, I'm in West London. It's a bit overcast. Ideal day for swing and seam bowling, though I never swung or seamed a ball. And may I join you in wishing happy birthday to Neil Harvey. When I was a very young boy in Mumbai, I saw Neil Harvey with the Australian team of 56 come and score a wonderful 100 and destroy my childhood hero Subhash Gupta, who I consider the greatest leg spinner in the history of cricket. And so says Gary Sobers. And if Gary Sobers says it, that's good enough for me. And of course, Neil Harvey's story is very interesting because some years ago when I met Nelson Mandela, he told me how in 1949, watching cricket behind a cage in Durban, he cheered Neil Harvey turn a test match round against the white South Africans. And of course, in those days, the black people always cheered the opposition team. And Neil Harvey made a brilliant century to win the match. So it's a great delight to be with you, Richard, having played so many cricket matches with you and worked with you on books and so on. And of course, lovely to be talking to John Holder.
We're very glad to have John Holder on the podcast. John was a county cricketer with Hampshire as a fast-medium bowler for several years from the late 60s and early 70s. He became a first-class umpire in 1983 and remained on the first-class list until 2009. In the midst of this, he became an international umpire in 11 test matches and 19 one-day internationals, though his international umpiring was interrupted in rather controversial reasons, which we'll come on to. John was, with John Hampshire, the first third country umpire in test matches, pioneered an experiment in a very demanding theatre in a series between Pakistan and India in 1989. He became an expert umpire for Test Match Special and for The Observer. But lately, he's been embroiled in a protracted struggle with the ECB over issues of discrimination, not just affecting himself, but affecting many other minority ethnic people as umpires and in cricket generally. We're going to talk about that, John, at some length. But for now, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. And it's good to be here. Thank you.
John, I'm going to ask first a few quick questions about your early life. And I can't resist asking you about the place where you were born, which the record book says calls Superlative St. George. That's a wonderful place name. What are its origins?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, Barbados is a British colony, so I presume that the name Superlative was given by the Brits. There is also, about a mile away, another area called Prerogative. So, you know, and there's another part of Barbados down on the northern part of the island called Jack in the Box Gully. So you've got some just different names, really. And I'm very, very proud to have been born and brought up in Superlative. I've got some fantastic memories. My mum and dad were there, obviously, my siblings. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother lived nearby, and one of my uncles. So I've got, it's only a small hamlet, really, maybe probably about 30 houses. But I've learned my cricket. Dad taught us all six children. I've got three sisters and two brothers. And dad taught us all to play cricket. There's just one main road in and out of Superlative. And dad taught us to play cricket in the street outside the house. So I've got really very pleasant memories of learning the game there.
Sounds like a wonderful cricket upbringing, John. Did you? I must get this out of the way. I've been asked this 1,000 times, I'm sure. But are you related to Van Burn or Jason Holder?
Not as far as I know.
Right.
No, not at all.
And among your early cricket memories, did you come across any great or future great West Indian players?
In my time growing up in Barbados, and once I started playing for the school, I played in the second division, and then I started playing the first 11 team. And we used the structure of cricket in those days in Barbados was that there were three boys' high schools, Harrison's College, Lodge, and Combermere. I went to Combermere, and each of those schools actually put out a team that played in the island's domestic first division cricket. So if you were good enough as a teenager, you played against people like Wes Hall, Charlie Griffith, all the test players. So it was a baptism by fire to some extent. I mean, in 1963, age 18, Charlie Griffith had just come back from England, having terrorised many of the England batsmen. And my high school, Combermere, we played him, captained by Everton Weeks. And we played against Charlie Griffith at his home ground. And the only concession he made to us youngsters was that provided we didn't get too many cheeky with little funky shots, he didn't bowl bounces, but he ran from the search screen ball at 90 miles an hour. it was really a baptism by fire, really.
Wow. Yes.
But your personal pride wouldn't allow you to just capitulate, so you learn to fight.
That's a great cricket upbringing.
You mentioned Charlie Griffiths, and of course, Charlie Griffiths was a very controversial fast bowler. The feeling was that he chucked, and I still remember as a schoolboy in Mumbai what happened when the Indians went on the 1962 tour of the West Indies. They had just beaten England in India, that was a B side. The best players of England hadn't gone. And of course, Griffiths hit Nari Contractor, the Indian captain and batsman. And I can tell you, having spoken to the Indian players of that generation in the dressing room, there was absolute chaos and terror. What was your feeling playing with Charlie Griffiths? Did you think he chucked the ball?
I think it looked suspect. It looked very suspect. And in fact, around about 1972, I went to do the advanced cricket coaching course at Lillishaw, and there's a picture of him there just prior to delivery, and the right elbow looked extremely bent prior to delivery. So it looked very, very suspect. I mean, we didn't have the sort of camera technology that we have now, which really analyzes bowling actions. But it certainly, to the naked eye, it certainly looked suspect. And I remember I came up to live in the Northwest back in 1974. And in 1977, Clive Lloyd's benefit year at Old Trafford, I played a lot of matches for him. And he said that Charlie Griffith was the only bowler he'd ever come across who could hit a batsman if he wanted to. He used to bowl from the edge of the crease, almost on the return crease, and angle the ball back into you. And he was, not only was he quick, he was very, very accurate. And he had his two favorite weapons were the bouncer and the Yorker. And the bouncer used to follow you. Most batsmen, when you get a bouncer, you start to sway backwards, but because of the angle at which he delivered the ball, when you sway backwards, it was following you. So it's very, very difficult then to change direction and go the other. By then, it's crashed into you. He was frightening.
There's one other West Indian fast bowler I want to ask you about, because I saw both of them in action when the West Indian team of 58-59 came to India captained by Jerry Alexander, a white man. In those days, West Indians still didn't have a black captain. Eventually, of course, Frank Warren came for that wonderful series in 60-61 against Australia, which led to the first ever tied test. And the and the bowler I saw, I've never seen a more fearsome attack. Both, there was Wes Hall and Roy Gilchrist, and both of them started their run-up from the boundary line. We had never seen anything like that. And in those days, India didn't have fast bowlers. They had great spinners. They had the great Subhash Gupta and Ghulam Ahmed and people like that. And Roy Gilchrist seemed to be the most fearsome fast bowler. And then I read stories about him playing in the Lancashire Leagues and so on. I mean, how? I mean, I was told, and what I've read, that Roy Gilchrist was a very tortured soul, and he would have been a very great fast bowler had Frank Worrell been in charge. I mean, you must have played against Gilchrist. What did you make of Gilchrist?
I played against Gilchrist up here in the Northwest, up in the Leagues in Lancashire in 1975. And I saw Gilchrist as a youngster in Barbados in a test series against Pakistan, where he hit the Pakistan captain, Hafiz Kardar, in the right shoulder with a bouncer, and it spun him around. He used to run from the sides. He's only little. He must have been 5'7", 5'8" maximum, long arms. And he raced in from the boundary. And then and on delivery, the left foot went high up in the air as he rocked back. And the batsman could actually, you could actually see the studs on his boots. As he, and he was frighteningly quick, but he was also very accurate. But what made Gilchrist extra dangerous, he used to bowl beamers as well. Yeah. A beamer is a killer delivery because the batsman is looking, the striker is looking for the ball to land on the pitch and then maybe bounce. The beamer comes straight from the hand at head height, and that just paralyzes you. So Gilchrist played up here for a club called Middleton in what was then the Central Lancashire League. And the stories of him are just horrendous, of just terrorizing opposition. I actually joined Hampshire in 1966. And in 90s, and I could bowl then genuinely fast. And we played Sussex second 11 at Portsmouth, at the United Services ground in Portsmouth. And in the opposition playing for Sussex was a man called Bill Lawton, who was married to Dora Bryan, big man. And he and I had a confrontation. I had knocked a couple of batsmen over and hit a couple of fellas, on one on the head and one on the shoulder. And Bill Lawton came in around about number seven on a pretty quick pitch. And I ended up bowling him a couple of bouncers, and he started to get nasty. I actually hit him on his chest, and he had to retire. When he got struck, this bouncer struck him. As I followed, he fell to the ground in slow motion. He was a big man. He fell to the ground, and I followed through and stopped, and stunned, because he clutched his chest just prior to falling. And I stopped and I sort of started to do wander over in his direction. And he jumped to his feet and he started to abuse me and abuse my captain, a chap called Leo Harrison, or the Hampshire second team captain. And he said, one of the things he said was, he called me a hooligan. He said, why have you allowed this young hooligan to bowl bouncers at me? And he made reference to, I have met your type before. And apparently he had captained a club called Oldham in the Central Lancashire League when Gilchrist was playing for Middleton here. And Oldham had bowled Middleton out for 50. And Middleton had Oldham in response 20 out for 5 with 2 men in hospital from bouncers and beamers from Gilchrist. And Bill Lawton, captaining Oldham, fearful for the safety of his players, walked on the field of play and called his players off the field and conceded the match. Gilchrist had a fearsome reputation.
I think the type of bowling John is talking about is always been interesting and very explosive. Fast bowling is a great art. It's very different to spin bowling or slow bowling. Spin bowling is more, if you like, a chess play with the batsman. Fast bowling is very direct. One ball can shatter everything. And there is nothing like watching a fast bowler run up and shatter the stumps. But the fast bowler can also pitch it short, which means pitch the ball in such a way that it rears up at the batsman at at his chest or at his face or at his head. And while the bouncer is allowed, though nowadays the bouncer is limited, but when the era I'm talking about, when I was a kid watching in the 50s and John is talking about the 60s, there was no limit on the amount of bouncers you could bowl. It's now the limit now. And the other ball, which was extremely dangerous, which you should never have bowled, was the beamer, which is a ball aimed directly at the head. It doesn't actually bounce at all. And that is a killer ball. If it hits you, and a cricket ball, let's face it, is a very, very hard ball. It's not a soft ball. I mean, it's not a soft ball tennis that I played with as a kid and we all played with as a kid. And, you know, so it's a very hard ball. So if you like, the art of fast bowling has always been considered in some ways a bit suspect, in the sense that is the bowler being legitimate? And, you know, we're talking of Charlie Griffiths about chucking, because you have to deliver the ball in a particular way with your action. You can't throw with your elbow. And therefore, there is, I think, John, you will agree, much more question of is this legal than in slow bowling. There's nothing in slow bowling in that sense that would be considered illegal, except in a very technical cricket sense.
Just make the point that there are no helmets in those days.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Physical protection for batsmen was much lighter than it is today, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Well, all batsmen had then really were some very, very flimsy gloves, batting gloves on their fingers, and some equally flimsy pads. And the thing about fast bowling is that there's a massive element of danger. When you're facing a ball traveling at 90 odd miles an hour, you've got a fraction of a second as a batsman to react. And there's always a that risk of danger of being seriously hurt. That is why eventually helmets and chest pads and so on, and the whole protective equipment with batting gloves and batting pads have improved out of all recognition to try and eliminate the risk of batsmen becoming injured or getting killed. So yes, in those days, it was up to the umpires. In those days, we're talking about Gilchrist and so on and Charlie Griffith, it was up to the umpires, but the umpires quite often, there were no professional umpires in those days, and the umpires quite often didn't want to get involved in what could have been deemed, you know, controversial.
John, I'd like now to move on to your county career a little bit. You, I think, migrated to Britain in your late teens. You worked for London Transport for a period. Assumed you played for a London Transport team. Perhaps you played on... I assume he played on London Transport's ground in Fulwell in southwest London. I just mentioned that because Mahir and I have played there a few times.
I think I only played one match on a London Transport ground, and that was one near Finchley.
Oh.
Most of my cricket, I only worked for London Transport for about 17 months. I joined in November 64, and by the end of March 1966, I'd gone to Hampshire. I played most of my cricket for a team called Caribbean, which was based around West London, Earlscourt area, and I also played for the BBC because the BBC had heard about me bowling very fast and terrorizing batsmen, and they had the late great, in my opinion, great Dr. Bertie Clark, CB Clark. He by then was playing for the BBC, along with a chap called Rodney Norville. Who came Barbadian like myself, and they heard of me and they invited me to come and play for the BBC. So I played a lot of my cricket for the BBC, and in actual fact, it was Bertie Clark who in those days said to me that I was wasting my time playing club cricket because I was knocking batsmen over left, right and centre. And he actually recommended me to Hampshire, where Roy Marshall, another a white Barbadian, was playing for Hampshire. So that's the reason why you went to Hampshire.
Roy Marshall was an idol of mine as a spectator. Roy Marshall was a great opening batsman who filled grounds, wasn't he? He was a sort of modern opening batsman who was really aggressive.
He was a great player. He used to thrash bowlers. I was lucky enough to see him close up. Unfortunately, he passed his best, but he was still a great player. And the thing about Roy was that there were certain bowlers that he didn't rate. And he felt that they should be hammered. one of them was Jack Bannister for Warwickshire, a little medium pacer. And he would get Roy out. Roy would go up there to utterly destroy him, thrash him out of the ground, out of sight. And he would play a false shot and get out. And he would be so angry when he came back to the dressing room. He'd hurl his bat across the dressing room because he shouldn't be getting wickets.
Well, I had the same response. I can't resist saying I had the same response when I dismissed David Steele of Northamptonshire in England, and very much the same response when I actually dismissed Collis King in a celebrity game. They were both furious, and they had reason to be. Yes.
Yeah.
When I became a cricket journalist, Jack Bannister had moved to the press box, and Jack Bannister was famous in the press box for being the bookie. He was offering always odds. He would sit in the back of the press box, And you could get odds from him as to how many runs a batsman would get or how many wickets. He was the press box bookie, you know, and a very, very, very interesting character. But in Hampshire, John, you played under Colin Ingleby McKenzie, the man who led Hampshire to their first championship. But didn't he have this philosophy when he was asked, what's your sort of message to the cricketers? That he said, as long as they can get to the ground for an 11:30 start, I don't care what they have done the previous night. Wasn't it something along those lines?
Yes, there was. In fact, I didn't play under him because he actually finished in 65 and I joined in 66. But I got to know him because he was a regular. He was a wonderful character. And one of his sayings apparently was that if you're not in bed by midnight, go home.
That's very nice saying. You did play with Barry Richards and Gordon Greenidge, didn't you?
Yeah, Barry joined in I joined in 66, and both Barry and Gordon joined in 68. So yeah.
You then had a Lancashire League career in the 70s. You became an umpire first class umpire in 1983. What made you decide to turn to umpiring, and what did you have to do to become an umpire then? Because in the old days it was rather loose-knit, wasn't it, the appointment procedure? If you were a kind of popular county professional, you could move over to being an umpire pretty easily. But what was it like for you in 1983?
Well, I wrote about 1980 and I was aged 35, and coming to the end of my playing career, I actually was looking for a career. I needed to do something worthwhile. And I started to miss first-class cricket. But I realised that at 35, I was too old to come back into first-class cricket as a player. And I thought of umpiring. And that really was a masterstroke in terms of job satisfaction and so on, and obviously achievement. That's career-wise, that's the best decision I made. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But I thought that... The first thing I had to do if I wanted to become an umpire, I felt I needed to learn the laws of cricket. So I actually enrolled in what was then the ACU, the Associated Cricket Umpires. ACU run courses during the winter on umpiring, on scoring, etc. So I joined one of these, a 10-week course at Manchester University Sports Ground, and learned the laws. Passed the exam, and then I thought, you can't umpire unless you know the laws, because how can you apply laws that you don't know? So that's the reason why I decided to go and do the training first. And in those days, in fact, up to probably sometime in the 1990s, as an ex-first-class player, you could retire from playing 1 year, and without not only doing the course, but without the TCCB or the ECB knowing if you had done any sort of training, you could be appointed to the first-class panel. So we had lots of umpires on the first-class panel who had never been in to learn the laws of cricket.
Richard mentioned that Peter Obon, who I'm substituting for, that nobody can ever substitute for Peter Obon, as we know, is interviewing Imran Khan. And perhaps the younger listeners, and I'm told we have millions of younger listeners, might like to be reminded that until well into the 90s, cricket was that unique game where they didn't have neutral umpires. And it was Imran
right.
Khan who kept agitating for neutral umpires. And you must have come in when actually the home cup. So for England played Australia in England, the umpires were English, which of course would never be possible in, say, football or rugby or something like that. And
That's
the other question to you, John, is that I remember talking a lot to David Shepherd, and in our class of umpiring, you know, the sort of village cricket match or matches we played, of course, the umpires come from the batting side, and our most difficult decision is always LBW. David Shepherd told me that for a professional umpire, it's not the LBW that's a difficult decision. It's the court behind that's a difficult decision, whether the umpire has heard the snick or not. Is that right? That the LBW is, in effect, a straightforward decision, which we find very difficult. The court behind is the one that is really difficult.
Well, it's not just... there are several decisions which are very, very difficult. And one of the very difficult decisions is bat pad. Now, the fabric from which the gloves are made is very similar to the fabric from which the pads are made. So when you got the ball turning square and bouncing, and you've got fielders, catchers close to the pitch on either side, sometimes you're not sure if the ball has come off the glove or the pad, because batsmen used to play with bat and pad together. And you weren't certain at time because the sounds are very similar. And sometimes it's just a millimeter of where the ball pitched between the end of the pad and the glove. So the LBW is reasonably straightforward. Catches behind are very, very difficult as well, not only because of the speed and the angle, but because of, you know, it could be a glove, it could be a shirt, it could be a trousers. There are several decisions out there which are very, very difficult. And as I said, with the fast bowling, that makes it much more difficult because things happen so quickly. The ball passes so quickly. You've only got a fraction of a second to make a decision, and inevitably you're going to get them wrong.
Well, this is probably the moment to ask you, what sort of difference has technology made to you in decision and DRS made to umpiring in general? Does it make life easier knowing that there's a mistake might get corrected, or is it put more pressure on umpires?
Well, for me, I'm a traditionalist, so I'm not one for DRS. I think the game is played by human beings and the decisions are made by human beings, umpires are human beings. But there's a big counter argument to that. The ICC, which keeps a record of all the mistakes or all the decisions, they reckon that the use of DRS has increased a percentage of correct decisions by about maybe sometimes 3 or 4%, and that at international level, it's really worth it. But I've actually had to come as a cricket lover, which I am still am. I've accepted it, but I was not in favour of it. It puts umpires and Mark Benson, the former Kent batsman, played a little bit for England, and he was a first class. He was actually an elite umpire for a while. And he found it humiliating. There was one test match where he had given a decision on the field, and he felt humiliated when having been given incorrect information or advice from the third umpire, he then felt humiliated at having to then turn and reverse his decision on the field. He said he felt, and with everybody watching this big screen, he had to look at himself having the decision analyze on screen first for everyone to see. And he said he was just feeling more and more horrible and then having to turn and change his decision. But I think it's a case now, if you want to be an elite umpire, if you can't stand the heat, you've got to get out of the kitchen, because the reality is DRS is here to stay. And as TV technology increases, improves, it's going to make umpiring decisions on the field are going to be even more high, and the mistakes are going to be even more highlighted. But it's not going to go away.
And yet, John, when Peter and I interviewed Simon Torfall, one of the things that struck me was the extraordinarily high percentage of decisions that are confirmed as right.
Absolutely.
That the top umpires get right.
Yeah, yeah. The reality is that you're under them. You know, as an umpire, when you walk onto that field, that you're under, every decision you make is under the microscope. And you just have to try and raise your concentration levels as high as you can and try to get every decision right. But humanly, you can't. I mean, my last test match was at the Lords in 2001, Australia. And I made one mistake. I made one mistake. I gave Graham Thorpe LBW to Brett Lee in England's second innings. And it was only after I realized that I'd got that wrong. But you just, as an umpire at that level, knowing the level of scrutiny, knowing that every decision you make is going to be replayed, analyzed, dissected, and possibly criticized, you just have to try and get your concentration levels high. Take, and when there's an appeal, you take your time, don't get flustered, and make your decision. But inevitably, you're going to get something wrong. That's the reality of umpiring.
John, you were, after really quite a short spell as a test match umpire, you were chosen with John Hampshire to be one of the first third country umpires, and in a very potentially difficult series between Pakistan and India. I think a great honour for you, and a great tribute to you, but what was it like actually handling that series, and how were your relations with the players and spectators different from the English tests in which you'd umpired?
It was a great experience. But let me say that of all test series between different countries, the India-Pakistan series are probably the most controversial, obviously because of the politics between the two countries. And when India toured Pakistan, the Indian players would call the Pakistani umpires cheats. When Pakistan toured India, the Pakistani umpires would call the Indian players cheats. So a lot of that was political. It wasn't actually what was happening on the field. Well, not as bad. So it was acrimonious. And so obviously John and I had slight apprehensions, but in actual fact, we had a fabulous, we got looked after so well. One of the important things as an umpire is to gain the respect of players. That's vitally important. If the players don't respect you, it makes your job very difficult. And that's one of the things that both John and I set out to do, to gain the respect of the players on both sides. We would talk to the players, sometimes share a joke, whether it be India player or Pakistan player. And like that, the players start to warm towards you, which I think in previous series between the two countries didn't happen. It was always the suspicion of the team, the visiting team, calling the home umpires cheats. So we didn't have that problem to deal with. So all we had to do was try and get our decisions right. We had the second test match in Faisalabad. There was a little bit of controversy there when India batting and we had some rain. In England, we had big wheel covers and huge sheets to cover the pitch with quickly. But at Faisalabad, there were only very small bits of matting to cover the pitch. So after it rained, the groundsman has got the very delicate task of taking these covers off without spilling the water on the pitch. And the Indian players complained to John and I, saying that the Pakistani groundsman, the local groundsman, was deliberately spilling water on the pitch, which he wasn't. It was just a nonsense, really. But the groundsman had a very, very difficult, very delicate job of getting these mats off without spilling water. So we managed to smooth that over because it wasn't really a problem. And then we had a problem then in three test matches, the second, third, and fourth test matches with India fielding. And the students in Pakistan can be quite aggressive. And this fit with the Indian fellows fielding on the boundary. In the second test in Faisalabad, Manoj Prabhakar fielding on the boundary, somebody lobbed a stone over his head. One of the students threw a stone onto the field, just lobbed over his head. That wasn't major. Well, it just happened the once. But then in the third test in Lahore, again with India fielding and a sparse crowd, really, and there was a group of students in there, very, very lively and aggressive, and the Indians fielding, and two Indian fielders fielding on the boundary, they started throwing stones, small stones, but throwing stones at the players or close to the players. And what was concerning about that was 20 yards away was about two dozen policemen sitting in the stands with their long bamboo lathi sticks. And they were seeing what was happening and they didn't do anything. So we had to stop the game. John and I had to stop the game, speak to some of the local officials who then spoke to the police and they then sorted the students out. But I mean, it was really annoying to see this happening. And the police were just sitting there chatting nonchalantly and watching cricket and not doing anything about it. But it became a real problem in the fourth and final test in Sialkot, where we had some like 30,000 people a day. And big, so we had a situation there when, again, India fielding, and Tendulkar was fielding at fine leg, and Mandrake was fielding at deep backward square leg on the boundary in front of a huge crowd of students. And there were some big stones thrown on. And the Indian captain, furious now, and Shrikant, he was so annoyed that he said he threatened to take his players off the field and forfeit the match. So John and I got involved, and we said, don't be so hasty. We'll go and talk to the local officials and to get them to try and sort things out. And the assistant district commissioner for Sialkot, he got on the tannoy and made an announcement, made an appeal to the crowd. And he said, we don't treat our visitors like that. And he appealed to the crowd to try to get rid of the troublemakers. And there was in that area with the students, there were some fisticuffs thrown and so on. And they evicted the students, and the game continued. So as far as John, and in fact, John reckoned that it was his best ever visit to Pakistan. He'd been on a Commonwealth tour previously as a player. And he said that some of the facilities and so on were horrible. But we got looked after so very well. So for us, it was a really positive experience.
I mean, it is possible to bribe umpires, isn't it? I mean, that would be the simplest thing to do if you want to win a test match. Make sure that you've got a white envelope with you know what inside it, slipped inside your umpire's coat, and, you know, then you give these decisions.
But it depends on the sort of umpire you have. I mean, for me, I love the game. I love the job. There's no way I was going to. I got offered money. I got offered £10,000 in Sharjah in 1993. To umpire a one-day international between Sri Lanka and the West Indies. I got offered £10,000 cash to make sure that two Sri Lankan batsmen put on a partnership of 85, and they would pay me this money. And there's no way I was going to do that, because I love my job, first of all. And if you start getting involved in match fixing as a player, as an umpire, you're entering a spider's web. And it means that these people... it means that if you're going to carry on in the job, in future, they'll be ringing you and telling you what decisions you have to make. I can live with that. But I can live with it for me as well. I love the job so much that I want it to be respected for doing a good job. When I give a decision, it's made for the right reason. I wasn't going to get involved in match fixing under no circumstances. So when I was off this money, I just told them, you've got the wrong person. I mean, these things have a habit of coming out in the public in sometime down the line. And then you got there. And if I had said yes, there's the very, very real possibility that sometime down the line it's going to come up that John Holder had accepted money to make decisions. And as far as John Holder all of a sudden is a cheat. My wife has got to live with a husband who's been branded a cheat. My two sons have got to live with it. Your dad is a cheat. I couldn't live with that. And I couldn't live with having to look over my shoulder, wondering when the phone is going to ring. I couldn't live with that. So I just said, thanks, but no thanks.
Well, very principled stand, John. Very wise one. Do you think, though, that without mentioning any names, do you have any suspicions or even knowledge that other umpires might have been tempted?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, players have been tempted. And if players have been tempted, I'm sure umpires will be tempted as well. And it's quite likely that some would have given in and accepted the money.
Because perhaps it's a little, we've had this discussion with others before, perhaps it's a little more tempting for players and umpires when it's a case of spot fixing rather than match fixing. You're trying to create certain... you know, individual moments with or milestones within matches rather than affect a match itself. You might think, well, that's not going to make all that much difference, the overall result. I'll make a little bit of money out of this in a relatively harmless way. I mean, if the infamous example, you know, Muhammad Amir and the Muhammad Azif in
that's
2010,
right.
They were just asked to bowl three no balls in a certain period. Well, you might think, well, three no balls isn't a big deal in a match. But it's the, of course, it's the principal thing. It's corrupting.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is the principal, and it may start with 3-0 goals, but I mean, look at the case of Hansie Cronje, and a former South African player who played cricket with Hansie Cronje said that he got entrapped when in the early stages the bribes were relatively small, but as time went by, they became more and more valuable, bigger and bigger, so a lot worth a lot more money. And then he was trapped. And because once you stay, yes, you can't back out, because they're going to blackmail you. So you've got to say no. And that's what happened to Cronje. I mean, that the declaration of the test match in with England, the last test, with Nasser captain, and Nasser apparently just probably realizing that he was desperate, just said no. So the asking target came down and down and down. I mean, all South Africa had to do, had there not been the acceptance of money and the bribery, all South Africa had to do was to draw the test match and win the series. But because of the captain had been involved, embroiled in match fixing and bribery, he got blackmailed, and he had to offer Nasser, England, a target, and it became ridiculous. And it was, in the end, it was a walkover, and England won the test match and drew the series. So that's, and after he got killed, a white South African man said to me that air crash was not an accident. He said the two pilots had flown that route on cargo so many times. He said they knew that route like the backs of their hands. And he reckons that it was murder, because Cronje apparently was about to publish a book, which would have blown the lid off and exposed the people who were at the top of this match fixing bribery.
That's an astonishing allegation, which needs to be investigated, certainly, and exposed.
John, you had a very distinguished career as an umpire, and as Richard has just discussed, you and John Hampshire were the first neutral umpires to be there in a test match between India and Pakistan of all countries. But then, having had a distinguished career, John, you were removed from the test match panel without being given any reason. And this was more than 20 years ago. And subsequently, after that, there hasn't been a person of colour in the test match panel in this country. And you brought a case against the ECB about racial discrimination. But you took a long time to bring the case. Why did you wait this long? And what do you think this lack of colour among the test match panel shows? Does it mean that there is racial discrimination?
It was the Black Lives Matter, the emotion caused by the murder of that black man by a policeman. It raised such massive emotion worldwide, and it really affected me as well. To think of, and because I actually saw the video of the policeman kneeling on this man's throat, and just thinking about it, that was horrible. And then Michael Holden made that impassioned statement at the Aegeus Bowl on the morning before a West Indies test, where he ended up crying. And it was just, and that just sort of highlighted a lot of the injustices that were being perpetrated on non-white people, really. And then I heard a story of Devon Malcolm. Devon Malcolm, Jamaican born, but played his cricket in England, played for Derbyshire. He played for Northants. He played for England with distinction. And Devon had applied to go on the first class umpires panel, having come to the end of his playing career, and was dissuaded from trying to become an umpire by an official at the ECB, when at the same time, the ECB was taking on white umpires, former first-class players, none of whom had achieved in English cricket what Devon had achieved. And I thought, well, that's got to be wrong. I mean, at least he should have been given the chance to do the training to see if he could fit the bill and do the job. But to be turned away and to be told that we have no vacancies, when at the same time they're taking on white people, white umpires, and as I said, umpires who hadn't done had made the sort of contribution to English cricket that Devon had. And then I heard the story of Ishmael Dawood. I think he's Indian born in Bradford, played his wicketkeeper, batsman, played cricket for Yorkshire. He played for Glamorgan, and I think he might have played for Derbyshire. And he had also had applied to go on the first-class umpires panel and was on the reserve list for a couple of years. And then suddenly, and seemed to be doing well, he said he was getting good reports about his performances. And then suddenly, out of the blue, he was sat without any reason, given any reason. So I started, and so we were contacted by a solicitor who started doing some digging. And the only common denominator was that we were all, it was all the black people who were being discriminated against, and because there was no justification for refusing Devon to try to become an umpire. There was no justification given for Ishmael Dawood and a couple of other non-white fellows who had applied to the ECB to become umpires and who were rejected. And the only common denominator was that they were non-white, whereas the ECB was taking on all white umpires. So I felt there was a need to expose what was happening, what was actually happening at Lords and being kept, and it was being kept quiet. And in fact, I spoke to a journalist from The Guardian called Barney Ronnie. And when I explained to him what was happening, he said, these people are actually hiding in plain sight. And that's what was happening at Lords. And the last non-white umpire to be taken on, I joined in 1983. My namesake, Van Bern Holder, another Barbadian, he joined in 1992. And he was in, and until now, since we made our public statements, a chap called Hassan Adnan, who played a bit for Derbyshire, Asian origin, he is the first non-white to be taken on in nearly 30 years. But it's only happened, in my opinion, since we made our exposure of what's actually happening at Lords.
Brought your action, I think, on public interest grounds, didn't you?
Yes.
You asked the employment tribunal to, because you were actually out of time.
Yes.
To take action on your own case, but you asked the employment tribunal to reopen the case on public interest grounds to take in all these very broad issues of discrimination. Now, I think they actually didn't accept that argument. They have decided the action is out of time. So where are you up to now with the ECB?
It's been over for months now. Oh. We knew that the tribunal was throwing us up. Or the whole idea behind bringing this action was to publicise what was happening at Lords and hopefully shame them into doing something about it. And it seems to work because all this racism was happening and non-white people were being denied, certainly umpiring. And in fact, by the ECB's own statistics, their staff was comprised of 89% white and 11% Asian, but there was not one person of black, African or Caribbean origin working for the ECB. Mm-hmm. And there had been, since Van Bern Holder in 1994, only white umpires had been appointed to the first-class panel. And this was, in our opinion, was a deliberate ploy. As I said, when you've got someone of the caliber of Devon Malcolm, a former England player, applying and not even getting a chance to see if he was good enough, to me, that's got to be, there's got to be something, it's got to be more than just a coincidence.
John, we had, as you may know, we had Lonsdale Skinner on the podcast some months ago. Mm-hmm. Made a very, very strong statement to us about the position in relation to coaching and Afro-Caribbean players. We put this to the ECB, who gave us a statement. And so I'd just like to repeat that invitation to the ECB to come onto the podcast, reply not just to you, but to talk about the whole area of discrimination in cricket. And we'd very much welcome their contribution on that. John, I'd like to ask you one more light-hearted question to end on. You were an expert umpire on Test Match Special, and you ran a very popular feature called You Are the Umpire on The Observer for a long time. What is the strangest, weirdest, or funniest situation you had to umpire and adjudicate on in serious cricket?
One of the things I wish I didn't like when we had 3-day cricket. When you have 3-day cricket on good pitches, it's difficult to get a result unless a team absolutely collapses and has a horror match. It's difficult to bowl teams out and win matches in 3 days. And so there was often in my years, especially when there was 3-day cricket, there were often situations where there was sort of joke bowling to be able to set a target for an opposition to try to win. There was some pretty friendly bowling. And at times it was dreadful because everyone was laughing. And as an umpire, you've got to be careful because everyone is laughing. And then suddenly and you relax your concentration. And then suddenly something happens and you've got to make a decision. But you're not in the right frame of mind. You're not in your concentration levels of win because of the atmosphere in which the game is being played. I hated that. I would rather the ball be swinging or turning and spinning and bouncing and people around the bat and there's lots of appealing. I'd rather umpire that because it really taxes you rather than this joke bowling where you're trying to give the opposition 100 or 200 runs so that you can probably chase the target. I hated that. For me, it just ruined the game. I remember umpiring a game at Hove where Neil Lennon, Les Lennon, the former Sussex player Les Lennon, his son scored a double century off bowling that was complete and utter garbage, but it's classified as a double century, a game between Sussex and Kent. And that, I hated that.
John, there's much more we could talk about. Perhaps like other guests, you'll come back and join us for a second innings. But for now, I'll just have to say thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And I'll say goodbye from me, Richard Heller, on South East London, which has turned a bit sunnier.
Thank you, Richard. And me here, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
And goodbye from me from West London. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, John.
And you. Thanks.